Okay. Thank you, everyone, for attending today. It's my pleasure to welcome you to our special event today entitled Conversations with Henry Mintzberg. This is an event organized to give our students an opportunity to not only hear from but also pose questions to one of the not only Canada's leading management thinkers but also one of the world's leading management thinkers. Professor Mintzberg, who has been with the faculty for a number of years, I should say, holds the John Claycorn professorship here at McGill. Prior to joining McGill, he did his PhD at MIT back in 1968, if I can say the year, and has been at McGill since. In terms of publications, Henry is pretty much uncompromised. Published over 150 articles, 15 books, covering the topics of management work, strategy formulation, and forms of organization. Here at McGill, he's also been the driving force behind a number of our executive programs, including the International Masters for Practicing Management, the Advanced Leadership Program, the International Masters in Health Leadership, and most recently, our Executive MBA program. Numerous awards have followed Henry, including being the first fellow to the Royal Society of Canada from the field of management. He's also an officer of the Order of Canada and the L'Ordre National du Québec, consistently ranked by the Wall Street Journal as one of the 10 world's greatest management thinkers. It's an honor, obviously, for all of us to have Henry here as a member of our faculty. What the format of today's session will be is essentially we will first be watching a little video which was produced by our NCS department here at McGill. It will be airing on Canal Savoir later in October as part of a series called McGill Making Headway. It covers Henry in terms of his research, his teaching, his thoughts on management, the International Masters for Practicing Management program, as well as his new book entitled Managing. After the video, we will be then progressing on to the interview section of today, which will be comprised of four of our students from the different core programs we have, including the BCom, the MBA, the Executive MBA, and the PhD program. And each of the students will be conducting a mini interview with Professor Mintzberg for about 10 to 15 minutes each. And given time, if we have time at the very end, we'll be able to open it up for general questions. But the structure of today's presentation will essentially be an interview format from students of the different programs. So with that, I'll turn it over, and we will play the video, and then we'll come back and we'll start the interview section.
Mintzberg and management. The two words have been linked together successfully for four decades. McGill professor Henry Mintzberg has developed an international reputation as perhaps the world's premier management thinker. His career was born out of a need he identified as a graduate student.
I did my doctorate at a time when people in business schools were not remotely interested in management. There was just no attention to management at all. There wasn't even a course in management where I studied at MIT.
So he decided to study managers. His doctoral thesis became the basis of his first book, The Nature of Managerial Work, published in 1973.
I studied managers, and what did I say in my first book that got the most attention? That managers are interrupted a lot, that it's a very action-oriented thing. That was patently obvious to anybody who had ever managed or spent a day observing a manager. It was patently obvious. So what makes me so special? Nothing. I just wrote it down, that's all. Nobody happened to write it down. I was there. I said, gee, it's not what everybody says. This isn't planning, organizing, coordinating, and controlling, to take the most popular words to describe management. This is about getting interrupted and trying to keep your head above water. And everybody said, wow, geez, so fantastic. And I said, I refuse to take credit. I just happened to be there. I wrote it down.
13 books later, Mintzberg has written what he calls his last book on management, aptly titled Managing.
Management is neither a science nor a profession. It's a practice, and the practice fundamentally doesn't change. What changes is the content of what you're dealing with.
He says if anything about management has changed in recent years, it's technology, and in particular, the onslaught of email.
I think it's driving a lot of the practice of management over the edge. That people are just too harassed and too short-term and too pressured. And you might see the effect of this current financial crisis as partly caused by that.
Over the course of his career, he has gone back and forth between studying managers and analyzing strategies.
Well, I've always argued that strategic planning is an oxymoron in the sense that strategies don't come out of a formally planned process. Most strategies, and the interesting strategies, tend to emerge as people solve little problems and learn things. And they don't come out sort of Moses coming down the mountain with the tablets. They come out as some little thought that grows into a major shift in how a company sees the world. So at IKEA, they tried to stuff a table into a, I can't remember if it was a car or a truck. The managers, they were taking a table somewhere and they couldn't get it in, so they took off the legs and they put it in, and then somebody said, well, wait a minute, if we can't get it in, how are customers supposed to get it in? And that led to them selling their furniture in knockdown packages, and that's the central heart and soul of their strategy, or one big piece of it. So that's how strategies develop.
In the mid-1990s, Mintzberg turned his attention to management education and the classic MBA, the Masters of Business Administration program.
The assumption is that you can create a manager in a classroom or create a leader in a classroom, which is even worse, and it's completely fallacious. It's an absolute sham. You cannot create a manager or a leader in a classroom. And I was kind of highly critical of MBA programs, and people started asking the embarrassing question that you should never ask an academic, which is, what are you doing about it? And it's kind of like, I'm not supposed to do anything about anything. I'm just supposed to criticize. Anyway, we got embarrassed into acting, and we created the IMPM, the International Masters in Practicing Management, and a whole series of programs that followed, culminating in what's called Coaching Ourselves, which is a kind of self-study thing. And the idea is that we wanted to change the whole philosophy of how managers were developed in classrooms.
The IMPM revolutionized management education. Participants are practicing managers who come from around the world. Together they explore management concepts as they relate to their real-life experiences. Seated at round tables, they engage in what Mintzberg calls friendly consulting.
The key is to tap into the natural experience of practicing managers. Most managers are thoughtful given half a chance, and they're in touch all the time, or they should be. If the senior management could get off their backs with all these individual performance targets and everything. We're all different people, but we're social animals too.
And the success of the IMPM program led to other programs, including a condensed version, the ALP, Advanced Leadership Program, in which companies send teams of six managers to sit at those round tables and tackle organizational issues. They learn from their colleagues' experiences, as well as from the other corporate teams, and they bring their insights back to their organizations.
So, I see partners as generating revenue, so I have resources to help partners.
So McGill's, I think, light years ahead of almost any other school. The only schools that are kind of with us in a way are some of the schools in England that have programs that are quite progressive in the sense of taking people who are managers and focusing on them learning by reflecting on their own experience. But in North America, that's almost unheard of outside McGill.
Other innovative programs include the International Masters in Health Leadership, IMHL, for managers from all aspects of healthcare, coming from all regions of the world, and the E-Roundtables, which bring together EMBA students from different programs around the world.
This is a lovely story. This guy who runs a factory in Mexico City attended one of our programs, and emailed us back this photograph when he got back, and he says, I put a round table in my factory, and now every time we have a problem, we get our team around the table to reflect on what the problem is.
From these programs sprang an independent study initiative called Coaching Ourselves. Conceptual materials and discussion topics are available via the internet. Now managers virtually anywhere can benefit from this kind of reflection and friendly consulting with colleagues. These innovative programs have allowed Mintzberg to see firsthand how managers function in a myriad of roles and organizations. He chose 29 managers to study for his latest book, Managing, from an orchestra conductor and bank CEO to a refugee camp director and the head nurse of a surgical ward.
The amazing thing is the variety of experiences. And at one point in the book, I say that it's like life itself, because managing is about almost everything in life itself.
He was struck by both the differences and similarities facing these 29 managers. His challenge was to synthesize their experiences into a concept of what is managing.
We know what managers do, we just don't have a decent conceptual description of it.
Mintzberg wanted to come up with a graphic representation, a visual aid, depicting the essence of managing. 20 years in the making, here is the Mintzberg model of managing.
The manager sits between the unit that's being managed. You know, if it's a sales manager, then it's the sales department. If it's a chief executive, then it's the whole company. And the world outside that unit. And I argue that people manage on three planes, if you like. Okay? The purpose of managing is action. The purpose of managing is to ensure and encourage the kinds of actions in the unit. That's the purpose of the unit itself. So sometimes people manage the action directly, but usually they're one or two steps back from that. So the second plane, one step back, is managing people, managing on the people plane to encourage them to take action. Dealing with people's problems, encouraging them, patting them on the back, holding meetings, all that kind of stuff. And two steps back is managing on an information plane. So it would be sharing information, collecting information, managing through information. A lot of management in large corporations today at senior levels is about managing the numbers. It's about giving people targets and making sure they meet them and so on. It's become so bad and so excessive on that plane that I call this management by deeming. You sit in an office and you deem that somebody will cut costs by 10%, and you fire them if they don't. I mean, my granddaughter, who's 4, could do that. That doesn't take genius. But that's managing on the information plane. But there's lots of functional parts. And my argument is that every manager has to manage on all three planes, although they may tilt towards one or the other, depending on the job they're in.
But he gets that in the program. And
Mintzberg argues that the recent financial crisis is in fact a crisis of management, the result of companies focusing on heroic leadership and the bottom line.
Organizations are communities of human beings. They're not collections of human resources where you kind of fire and hire and, you know.
He calls for
like
communityship. Companies must be rebuilt as communities.
And I think a lot of companies have totally lost the sense of community. Largely because of all these downsizing and mismanagement and too much leadership hype, which takes puts the emphasis on single individual as the be-all and end-all of the future for the company, as opposed to recognizing the role of middle managers and the critical role of middle managers. So we need to rebuild that sense of community in our organizations.
Known as a straight talker, Mintzberg argues the days of obscene compensation packages should be over.
The claim, which is a phony claim, it's a kind of old boys network claim, is that if you don't pay these bonuses, you won't get the best people. I reverse that and say quite the opposite. Anybody who demands these bonuses demonstrates that he or she is not a team player, that they're not concerned with the long-term interests of the company, and the very fact that they're demanding these bonuses should exclude them from the job.
An avid outdoorsman, Henry Mintzberg prefers spending his free time away from organizations. He appreciates the industriousness of the beaver and collects what he calls their discarded beaver sculptures.
See, they eat most of the bark, but not all of it. It's this idea of serendipity in a way. It's this idea that you kind of learn from things that just happen. And art is something, it's not just what we make as art consciously, it's also what just happens. Some artist, you know, some inadvertent artist, namely a beaver, I guess we can call them inadvertent artists, just come up with something that's absolutely beautiful. And that's the way I view strategy, you know, it's like the wheels, it's like the legs on the table, you know, they just come up with things inadvertently that change the world.
Kind of like Mintzberg himself, an observer of nature and human nature, whose inadvertent research path has led him on a journey to change the world of managing.
specific. So.
Great. So we're going to be moving on then to the interview portion of today's session. And we'll be, as I mentioned before, having representatives from the four core programs we have here, the BCom, the MBA, the Executive MBA, and the PhD program. First will be Audrey Mockel from the BCom program. Audrey is currently a fourth-year Bachelor of Commerce student with a concentration in strategy and the social context of business, as well as a double minor in politics, law, society, and philosophy. Audrey was an intern in the Department of Justice this past summer and looks to go to do graduate work in human rights and law following graduation. After Audrey, we will be having Jean-Pierre Bierd, an MBA student, currently a second-year MBA student in the Global Strategy and Leadership concentration. He is also the Vice President External for the MBA Student Society and spent 6 years with Lehman Brothers in Tokyo prior to joining the MBA program. Third, we will have Jan Schoening, one of the members of our first McGill-HEC Executive MBA program. Jan is currently the president North America of Homburg Investments, an international real estate company with assets in Europe as well as North America. And finally, we will be having Guy Azevedo, a PhD candidate in the strategy and organization area, and also the founder and former president of the Desotel Doctoral Student Society here at McGill. So please join me in welcoming all of our interviewers, as well as Professor Mintzberg, and we will start off with Audrey and her questions.
Okay, my first question is, what is the greatest misconception surrounding the managers of this generation?
I think it's the confusion of management and leadership as if they're separate. Nobody wants to be led by somebody. Nobody wants to be managed by somebody who's not a leader. Nobody should want to be led by someone who's not a manager because they don't know what's going on. So there's lots of misconceptions. I could go on and on. But I think the idea of somehow singling out leaders as if they're different from managers, and also the idea of isolating leadership qualities as if somehow they exist independent of context. Leaders only exist in context. They exist because people choose to follow them and respect them. So I'm very uncomfortable about a lot of the leadership stuff.
Out of the 29 managers you researched for your book, which manager, if any, stood out as being the most innovative, and what separated him or her from the others?
That's an interesting question. I'm not sure. I would identify several as being quite innovative. I think the interesting thing is that they were all kind of craftspeople, craftsmen, craftswomen, in some way or another. In other words, they were able to deal with the issues they were facing in quite creative ways, even if it's a small thing. So in one way, the most conventional manager might have been Abbas Goulet, who was running a refugee camp for the Red Cross in Tanzania. And that was management by exception, because that place could blow up in a minute. And he was watching everything like a hawk to make sure that nothing would go out of control, but doing it in his own kind of creative way. At the other extreme is a guy named Alan Whelan from BT, British Telecom, who was the sales manager for big projects for BT, and kind of a middle manager in a way, and probably the most strategic of any of the people I observed. He just had a real sense of, because what does it mean to be strategic? It means to understand the specifics but see them in a very conceptual way. And he was articulating constantly, and I think the Brits are particularly good at that. They can kind of see things in very broad ways. So he was interesting, and he was creative. Just a little story. At the end of he was also in our IMPM program, and at the end of the first module called the Reflective Mindset, everybody was going around saying, "So nice to meet you, so nice to meet you." And Alan blurted out and he said, "It was so nice to meet myself." So he's a kind of creative guy.
Aside from the core topics taught to management students, such as finance, economics, accounting, which other areas of study have effective takeaways for managers? Should a management education include the study of social sciences and humanities or other disciplines?
Well, it depends when. I'm a great believer that in the BCom program, we should have an awful lot of material rooted in the basic social sciences, not just the conventional ones like economics or psychology. Anthropology wouldn't be bad. History wouldn't be bad. I think a lot of those things are really good for a deep grounding. And I think, frankly, look, most undergraduates don't end up in the field they studied. I think most MBAs probably, if they specialize in finance, they don't necessarily end up in finance. So people are not sure where they're going to end up. So the idea is really to think. So at the bachelor's level, I think it's critically important that we focus on basic, absolutely basic stuff. And when you get in the MBA, the strength of the MBA, because I did talk about both sides, the strength of the MBA is in the functions and teaching the business functions, marketing, finance, accounting, and so on. That's where MBAs are very strong. I don't think they're strong in teaching management, and I don't think they do much to teach management, but they're very strong in the functions, and that's appropriate at that level. You're not going to start teaching people philosophy in an MBA program, but you could be teaching people philosophy in a bachelor's program. And then in the PhD, which is philosophy, of course it's different again. But interestingly, we come back, because in the McGill's PhD program, there's a requirement for two courses in a core discipline. So for example, if you're interested in strategy, you might be doing two basic courses in history or in, I don't know, whatever sort of economics, whatever is appropriate.
It's been argued that ensuring socially responsible business practices can't be left to managers alone, as they're said to be incapable of reconciling them with the goal of maximizing profits. Do you believe that managers have the ability to balance these competing interests, or should the checks and balances be left to policymakers while profit maximization is left to managers?
I feel very strongly on both sides of that issue. If you don't have responsible people in important positions, you're dead as a society. So if they're all Madoffs and people like that, you're dead. You can't function in society with irresponsible people in important places. So you can't just leave it to other people. On the other hand, business doesn't exist for social policy. So you don't want business people making social policy, because often they'll make policy that's, if you're a health insurance company in the United States, you're not these days being necessarily socially responsible. You're doing everything you can to protect your profits. So you don't want corporations meddling in political issues, which of course corporations do increasingly, and in the U.S. system it's impossible. Look, Milton Friedman says that the business of business is business, that business people should stay out of social issues completely. That's the other extreme. Well, find me an economist who will agree that social issues have no economic consequences. Every social issue has costs, so they have economic consequences. Well, then I ask the same economist, find me an economic issue that has no social consequences. Every economic issue has social consequences. And if people who are making economic decisions ignore the social consequences, then you get an awful society. In fact, you get exactly the society we're getting increasingly right now. Irresponsible people who couldn't care less about anything but their bonuses and profits. And you can stay within the letter of the law and still be terribly manipulative. For example, the lobbying that's taking place on the U.S. healthcare is absolutely irresponsible from a social point of view. But it's not illegal. It should be illegal. Companies shouldn't be allowed to spend huge amounts of money influencing social policy, because the people on the other side don't have that money to counter them. So when a businessman or businesswoman says to me, I want to be socially responsible, I say, good, let's start with your lobbying. You want to be socially responsible? Don't lobby. So we won't find too many people agree with that.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Audrey. So now we'll move to JP from the MBA program.
Well, thank you very much for being with us tonight. You were touching on the limits of teaching management in the classroom. Yeah. You mentioned it in the short video that it's really hard to create a manager in the classroom, that it's not a science nor a profession, that it's a practice. We understanding the limitations that we have, mm-hmm. is there anything you would advise students, or anything that you think can help, or can is there a shortcut really to being a good manager?
Well, I think a lot of people in MBA programs think it's a shortcut to being a good manager.
Which I think in the past you have disagreed
yeah,
with.
Yeah, you know, 2 years and you're ready to manage. At least that's what Harvard tells you, and most MBA programs tell you. Or if you go to INSEAD, it's 10 months, which is even a shorter cut than that. But I don't think that's a shortcut to managing at all. I don't think there's a shortcut. I think what some people believe, and I believe it, is that you can accelerate. Management's learned on the job. You learn it by doing it. You learn it by experiencing it. Okay. The shortcut, in a way, that people have argued for, is to give people lots of challenging positions in management so that they get challenged in different ways. It's not a shortcut exactly, but it's shorter than staying in the same job for 20 years. I think a lot of the companies move people around much too quickly these days. You know, it's 2-3 years and you're out. 2-3 years is not enough to really make a mark and get things going. So I think they move people around a little too quickly. Mm-hmm. But that's a possibility. But look, management is not a science because we don't have a lot of factual evidence about how you make decisions or what you do and so on and so forth. Management is not a profession because you've got Barack Obama, who never studied management, who seems to know what he's doing, and George Bush, who has a Harvard MBA and didn't seem to know what he was doing. So management, an MBA doesn't make you a manager. What an MBA does is ground you in the functions of business, which is great, especially if you're going into business. If you're going to an NGO or into government, I kind of have my concerns about being grounded in the business functions.
Excellent. There seems to be a tendency in most organizations to promote people that perform very well in their job. So the best mm-hmm. the best salesperson will lead the sales team,
yeah.
or the best. In most places it tends to happen that way. How do you feel about that? And is there a way to identify those people that have the potential to become great managers?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, you're dead right. I was smart enough to remain a professor all my life. I don't know what kind of manager I would have made. I mean, I have managed certain things, but I happen to like what I'm doing anyway. But you're right. A lot of companies, a lot of organizations will promote people that way. But a lot, I think, are sensitive to that issue too. So how do you identify the people? I think there's a lot of social skills associated with them and so on. But the part of my book I like best is the beginning section in a chapter called Managing Effectively, where I say if you want to be an effective manager, what should you be? What characteristics should you have? And I say, well, find a list of successful characteristics. So I found one at the University of Toronto Rotman School, because I come from McGill, so obviously you might as well let them have it. So I took their list, to be fearlessly decisive and stuff like that. And I said, well, wait a minute, where's intelligence on this list? Surely you've got to be intelligent. And where's energy on this list? How can you be successful without having energy? So I said, well, for the sake of a better world, I should really do a comprehensive list of all the lists. So I listed 50 items that I could find and some that I invented and said, if you really want to be successful, you've got to be all 50. But Superman wouldn't be doing it. And then I get into a discussion of the inevitably flawed manager, that managers, like everybody else, like all human beings, are flawed. And they're successful because their flaws are not fatal under the circumstances. By the way, one of the items on the list, the only one that has empirical evidence really, is tall. There's this wonderful, if you're not going to read the book, read the footnote on that table that talks about a study done in 1920s, around 1920, about how managers tend to be taller than other people, or the more senior the manager, the taller. So, for example, archbishops are taller than bishops and things like that. It's wonderful. It's hilarious because they forgot about Napoleon, but anyway.
A last question. You're clearly pretty good at understanding managers, and it's interesting that as an academic you were able to get that without experience in management yourself. We know that your wife is a practicing manager. As do you think she's had an impact on your research and on your findings over the year?
Yeah, I better be careful because you're up there. yeah, absolutely. She's also very wise. So she reads all these things and just comes up with these very quiet, kind of straight to the point ideas that completely shoot down some of the things I try and write. So, no, very, very helpful. She's also, I think, the kind of manager I sort of promote in the book, which is modest, thoughtful, quiet, not the big, huge, I'm the great leader. And I was in an MBA class a few days ago, not in McGill, and somebody said, so who are the leaders in this room? Raise your hand if you're a leader. And about four or five hands went up. And I thought to myself, those are not the leaders. Leaders don't appoint themselves. Leaders don't say, I'm a leader. Leadership is earned by what other people choose to respect or do with you. That's what leadership is earned. It's not self-appointed. And by the way, for people in this room, the thing I like least is what's called young leaders. Because young leaders, first of all, how can you have a young leader? You don't know yet whether they're going to be. I don't know if Mandela was identified as a young leader at the age of 20. I have no idea, but I would suspect maybe not. But you can't. Leadership is earned from experience and earned from people who do things. And young leaders, in my experience, are usually selected by more senior people who never experienced their leadership. And the most dangerous thing in management, and I think what's causing a lot of problems, is when we select managers or chief executives or anybody else, we rarely get the opinions of the people who know the candidates best, namely the ones who have worked for them. You really want to, if you want to find out somebody's flaws and characteristics, you can do one of two things. You can either work for them or marry them. And you'll find out quite quickly. But if you're a mature human being and you made a good choice, you know you can live with a lot of those flaws. But in choosing chief executives and other managers, it's often senior people who have never, sometimes they're married to them, I guess, but usually they've never worked for them, so they don't really know. There was when Bolton was put forward by Bush for the ambassadorship in the United Nations, he was described in the congressional hearings as a kiss-up and kick-down sort of guy. We have too many kiss-up and kick-down managers.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Next, we'll turn to Jan from the MBA program.
Good evening. This is pretty demoralizing because at 5'10", I just found out that I reached my ceiling in my career, and I spent a fortune on the EMBA program. In a previous life, I was a general manager for several hotels with Fairmont. In the past 10, 15 years, the entry ticket into Fairmont's head office was an MBA. Being on the field, it was surprising to see how little they understood of hotels, and yet they received lots of power. After reading your book, Managers Not MBAs, I found my sanity back, as I realized I wasn't alone. My question, do you believe McGill can play a role in bringing companies back to earth and letting them focus again on their core competencies as opposed to strategic plans and spreadsheets? How about a TV show, a Dr. Henry, or coaching ourselves? Any ideas?
Well, the TV show might be fun when I have a few minutes, probably in about 20 years. As far as if you're getting an MBA, bear in mind that you need to learn the business. You need to know the business. And if you haven't come in knowing the business and getting an MBA and going back to that business, don't assume that you can just flit out to any business and be able to manage in that business. People won't respect you, they won't know. So devote yourself to something you believe in, get to know it, and so on and so forth. I think McGill is doing a lot with the kind of program you're in, Jan, the EMBA McGill HEC program, for example. Even our BCom has been revised along some of the lines that we've been doing in other programs. So McGill's BCom is probably quite different now. I mean, the MBA is quite different from most MBAs. But I think we're contributing in the sense of a number of these programs, and also people are starting to copy us. Somebody once said that a new technology takes 20 years to become an overnight success. The IMPM has been going for 14 years, and people are starting to notice, which is amazing. We've got six years to go, and people are still are noticing already after a mere 14 years that we're doing something different. So I'm being a little facetious, but there's hope.
Each of the past so many decades were characterized by a management fashion. We've seen come by the quality circles, total quality management, ISO 9000, benchmarking, etc., etc. One would expect that the Enrons of this world and the current financial crisis will help shape the next management fashion. What do you think the next one will be?
I have no idea what the next one will be because it's totally random. Whoever can hype it up the best and find, a blue ocean. I don't like metaphors. Blue ocean implies red ocean, and I don't like those kind of metaphors. But you never know what's going to come next because it just seems almost arbitrary. So all I can do is say what I hope will come next, and I would call it common sense. I think what we need is for common sense to become fashionable and to remain fashionable. Good managers just have a lot of common sense, and they kind of know what's going on, and they're in touch with things that are going on, and they're not running around hyping up the latest technique. When somebody says to me, what's hot? The worst thing anybody can say to me is that I'm a brand, but the second worst thing anybody can say to me is, what's hot? If it's hot, it's probably wrong. But it's not only that it's wrong, it's that if you adopt it because it's fashionable, then you haven't thought it through. So I say to companies, if you want to adopt the latest technique, number one, think it through and see if it fits you, and then number two, change the name. Don't call it whatever it's called, empowerment or whatever it is. Don't call it what's popular. Call it something else so you'll have to explain it, and then you'll have to understand it. So common sense is next, I hope.
When you're planning to invest in a TSX-listed company, what do you base your decisions on? How do you evaluate a company?
Well, that's quite simple because a number of years ago, I got out of the stock market totally. And I said in this room about 2 years ago that anybody who's got money in the stock market is crazy and they should get it out. But I also said it about 6 years earlier, so I was a little ahead, a little too early. Number one, I'm staying a million miles away. I even told my broker a number of years ago, nothing in bonds. And she said, but blue chip bonds, like AIG, I guess she meant. And I said, no, not in blue chip bonds, nothing in because I saw such depreciation of publicly traded corporations, not all of them. There are lots of well-run publicly traded corporations, but too many of them are being driven by this short-term quarterly earnings. Completely nuts. You take a company that's doing tens of billions of dollars, it's got 100,000 employees, and you think you can measure the change from January to April in how that company is doing? It's completely crazy to drive people that way. And the whole bonus system, as I said in the video, the bonuses should be eliminated because we can't, I don't know if it's in the video, but we can't measure the long-term impact of a chief executive. We can't measure. We don't know how to measure it reliably, partly because a company is influenced by more than the chief executive. And if you can't measure, and you can't attribute everything to the chief executive, either all successes or all failures. And so the idea of paying any bonuses is crazy. Bonuses should be eliminated, period. So the answer to your question is, if I'm going to put money, I will try not to put money in most publicly traded corporations unless I feel they're being managed for the long run by people who really care about the place. And that usually means the entrepreneurs who created them. But then, of course, the whole thing is dependent on a single individual, because you don't know what will happen after the entrepreneur goes.
That's especially the last paragraph that I was hoping you would focus on. Imagine the following situation. Your 20-year-old godson comes to see you for advice. His name is Jack, named after his uncle, Jack Welch. His father became wealthy thanks to the big bonuses his bank paid him. Uncle Henry, I'm dying to enter the business world and make tons of money, just like Uncle Jack and my dad. How can I best prepare myself for the future?
Well, I said a little bit of that before. Find an industry that really fascinates you. Get to know it really well. Dedicate yourself to it. And earn your stripes. Show the way Uncle Jack did, who stayed with that company through most of his career, General Electric. Show that you're capable of doing this. And if you are capable, you'll move up and do well. But don't focus on the money. Focus on doing the best job you possibly can. Keep your eyes focused on doing really, really well. You better play the politics a little bit too, because you won't get there. But prove yourself and devote yourself and really understand something. And then, when you're about 40, come into the IMPM and reflect on your experience as you go on.
Thank you.
And Leslie Gee, yes, from the PhD program.
Thank you. And Henry, you should also add, he should not go to a PhD.
Yes. Yeah, yeah, sir. Yeah, don't. Whatever you do, don't get a PhD, because otherwise all you'll do is enjoy life.
Yes. So I have three questions here. The first one is on management, academia, and schools. Following the U.S. financial crash of last year, many people, including Queen Elizabeth II, turned to economists for explanations. So this gives us the impression that society really does not rely very much on management scholars, management departments, or business schools to deal with what we see as managerial problems. And the public normally is going to see economic issues or even ethical issues to which we are more often part of the problem than part of the solution. So perhaps people see the economists as belonging to a higher league. The economists themselves say that they have a Nobel Prize for economics. They circulate in higher government and international levels, agency levels, and they do not trade or brand their schools or departments in the same way that that we do. So a question that I have to you is, now, beyond the walls and the literature of our field, some 100 years after Taylor and Fayol, do management schools and management scholars matter at all?
Well, they certainly matter, because I think they're a big part of the problem. I think the crisis, a lot of Harvard Business School graduates in those very senior positions like George Bush or Rick Wagoner at General Motors, so they certainly matter. I think they can matter for the better. And the most positive side, I think, this idea of economics being the noble kind of social science, economists tends to attract a lot of very smart people. There's, of course, no Nobel Prize in economics. It's just a sloppy press that lets them get away with that. That prize was created long after Nobel was dead by the Bank of Sweden. Everybody calls it a Nobel Prize. It's not a Nobel Prize at all. But, you know, I mean, the astrologers can create a prize, too, and call it a Nobel Prize. They didn't call it. They called it a Memorial Prize in honor of Alfred Nobel and got away with it being taken as a Nobel Prize. But economists are smart people, and I have much to say. But every social science has one or two concepts that are key. And in economics, it's markets. And in psychology, it's cognition or behavior. In anthropology, it's culture. And sociology, it's crowds or mobs or I don't know, whatever you want to take it to be. And a balanced society is a society that listens to all those different social sciences and balances them. Now, exactly what you're saying, Guy, has been a complete imbalance because economists have had the ear of policymakers and others haven't, whether it's management people, organization theorists, or others. They just haven't had the ear of policymakers the way economists do, and things have tilted completely in that direction. I also think it's due to the fall of the Berlin Wall and the collapse of communism in Eastern Europe, because the assumption was that capitalism triumphed in 89, and I think that's dead wrong. I think balance triumphed. We were balanced between governments and markets and the social sector in between, but ever since we've been going out of balance on the economic side. Blame economists, but also blame people who are listening too much to economists. There's kind of three levels of human behavior, if you like. There's a macro sort of behavior, which is social behavior, that economists and political scientists and sociologists and anthropologists look at. There's individual or group behavior. Psychologists look at that. A very important level in between is the organizational level. And a lot of what happens in society happens in organizations. But the reason people don't see this crisis as a management organization crisis is because they don't think in those terms. So they don't see it. In that sense, we failed, because I think we have things to say about that, but we haven't succeeded.
Okay, so I have a second question that it's about the way you work. It's about a retrospective of your work. I know part of your work, and sometimes I like to see it as a kind of succession of different graphic or visual art periods. We have these organic shapes representing organizational types, these longitudinal sequences of boxes to track strategy, flows of arrows, planes, slabs. I had my own fair share of triangles and other things too. So my question is, and I ask you, trying to get a bit into your mind. When you create and develop a theory, when you publish your work, do you think in shapes? And how long does it take to learn to draw or to learn to write as a child?
Those shapes, those designs. I use a lot of those graphic designs. I think they come along with other things, because I usually when I'm writing, I'm kind of playing with concepts and words and things scribbled all over pieces of paper all over my desk. And by the way, I write. I don't type. I write. Santa can tell you, because she has to somehow render it all.
She's
on
the one
paper.
Who types, yes.
but I write, and the reason I write is because writing is about integrating a lot of different thoughts together. When you put a keyboard down, you pushed everything away, and I need everything around me. So I have just a pad like this and all kinds of notes around that I can pull and push and so on. But I think, so I start with that and notes and things. But as it starts to form, I start to try and depict it graphically. I think it's the last and probably only remnant of my training in mechanical engineering, which I never practiced. But I think as a mechanical engineer, you tend to kind of do things that way. I've been surprised by the fact that I have great trouble getting other people, particularly when I'm working with doctoral students, to see things in those terms. Usually if I say, show me something, I'll get a 2x2 matrix. And it's, I haven't seen many people who do that, but I'm not sure why. I'm not sure why I have that kind of skill.
Okay, so it gets us to my last question, which is a very general one. I know of your curiosity and the energy you have to discover new and different places. You say and you wrote that you hate to fly, but after all the work and travel you do, after spending parts of your summers in Prague every year, and after teaching all around the globe, Sasha, and you pick the most unsuspected destinations for your holidays. You go to the mountains of Bhutan, to the rivers of Amazonia, to the tundra and glaciers of Iceland. And I also know of your attention and your critical take on the Canadian reality and also U.S., Europe, Asia, and all around. You globetrotter, open-eyed, and the world also comes to you. So because I enjoy and I appreciate very much your sense of observation, I'd like to ask you, how do you see this world today? Where do you think we are going in social, political, economic, and even in managerial terms? I hope you brought your crystal ball to answer this one.
Well, I try never to predict, because I think pessimists predict what they don't like and optimists predict what they do like. Nobody ever gets it right. The only thing we seem able really to predict are sort of repetitive, sarcastic things like, you know, we can predict that you better wear a coat in Montreal in January. We can predict that kind of stuff. But we don't. Nobody ever gets it kind of right. So I'm a bit hesitant to do that. If you look at global warming, there was an item, but this is just indicative of everything that's going on. If you look at global warming, there was an item about China finally biting the bullet and announcing that they're going to kind of cut emissions. And the comment was that if they do that, it will reduce the increase in China. In other words, if they do what they said, which was considered a radical, wonderful, new decision, what they're actually doing is saying we will not add as much to the coming emissions as we've been adding in the past. And that leads me to a conclusion, which you know very well, which is that I have less and less faith that governments are going to solve any of the big problems. And I'm not coming from a right-wing perspective that says governments are incapable, because I don't think markets are going to solve them anymore. I think they'll be worse. In fact, I think the reason governments can't move is because markets have so much political influence in government these days. The governments are, when governments move, they move very marginally, unless you get someone like Chavez or someone, but these aren't your common politicians. Governments are very conservative, which is fine most of the time, but when you've got a real crisis like global warming, we're just playing. We're just playing, and if the facts are bearing it out, we're just in the process of destroying ourselves. Sometimes I think, are we gonna falter from external pollution or internal pollution? External pollution is global warming and all that, and internal pollution is the food we eat and the chemicals we ingest and all those things. So I'm not very optimistic about that. I am optimistic about people in communities when we can break people away from the phoniness of, you know, image and all those kinds of things, that, you know, people who do things strictly because it's stylish or because everyone else is doing it, when people start thinking for themselves and work in small communities as to what affects them, I have great faith in that. Whether it's too late, you know, if I had to predict, it would be pessimistic. So I just because I think things are getting, things look dangerous on the warming front. But who knows? There are these different forces, and we'll see what dominates.
Thank you.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Audrey, JP, Jan, and Guy, for your probing questions, and Henry for your insightful answers. We have roughly about 20 minutes, so what I'm going to do is open the floor up to questions from the audience. So if you have a question, please raise your hand. And we'll get a microphone towards you. So.
In the video, if I heard correctly, it said that this will be your last book on managing. Mm-hmm. And so my question is that true? And if it is, what are you going to write on now?
It's almost true, in a way. I'm finishing something called Managing the Myths of Healthcare, but that's kind of a monograph. It'll be about 80 pages, so it's not quite a book. What I'm really turning my attention on is something called Getting Past Smith and Marx Towards a Balanced Society, which is what I was alluding to before about the balance between markets and governments and the social sector. And that's a kind of major effort. I see it as a kind of an electronic pamphlet, sort of the pamphlets that were written by what's his name in the American Revolution, Payne, Tom Payne, John Payne, Tom Payne, and those sorts of things. So I'm working on that. That'll take a lot of time. And then there's just a lot of personal writing. It's actually all written. I just want to get it published. I have about 15 short stories I want to do in a book called Reflections from the Window. All various other things that are sort of more of a personal nature. I thought someday I'll write a book called What I Really Think. All the things that I'm not supposed to say that I really believe. So I figure if I just do what I want to do, I've got 15 years of more work at least, so I better live quite long.
You mentioned that it's important for anyone to, if they have managerial interests, to have a commitment in a particular industry and to slowly move up in that industry, assessing, I guess, their strengths and also learning the business before they actually could say that they understand the business. And you did mention, you made one statement saying that they should also pay attention to organizational politics. And what I wanted to ask is, in your perspective, what would you say is the ultimate aspect of organization politics that a new manager should focus on?
Probably the ultimate aspect is to keep it in balance. If you're not attuned to the politics, you're going to be walked all over. If you become a totally political animal, you're going to walk all over everybody else. So you've got to be attuned to it. It happens, particularly in big organizations. There are things that happen. But if you're living that and eating that all day long, you're in trouble. Obama's interesting. I mean, in government, obviously, politics figures a heck of a lot more than it does in most businesses. If it figures that much in business, you're in trouble. But Obama was interesting because obviously he was in the midst of a deep political issue. But he managed to play it pretty straight. I mean, he didn't get sucked in by a lot of it. He just managed to walk that fine line. And by the way, I think he's an interesting example, from what I can tell from a distance, of someone who obviously has leadership capabilities but doesn't take himself that seriously and has tremendous managerial capabilities. I mean, just the image of that guy walking around with his BlackBerry throughout that campaign, he was plugged in, I mean, so to speak. He really knew what was going on. So I think from a distance, you never know until you're there, but he strikes me as someone who obviously knew he had to play the politics. Kerry's disaster was that he didn't. But, you know, the absurdity of being accused of not being a war hero and letting them get away with that when George Bush didn't even have the guts to serve in Vietnam is astonishing. And that Kerry didn't get up and just make mincemeat out of him. He could have turned that around and destroyed Bush on that, you know, on that basis. But so he didn't play the politics very carefully. Obama, I think, walked that nice fine line.
Hi. I was wondering what your view is on the positive or negative role of management consulting with respect to all the different topics we've talked about tonight, leadership, strategy, management, and any of the crises we've faced, et cetera. What are your general thoughts on that whole type of industry?
Well, there's all kinds of consulting. I mean, you know, there's great consulting and there's terrible consulting. The consulting I don't like are the people selling the latest technique and everybody's got to do it, and that kind of consulting I don't like. Thoughtful consulting is fine. I always thought there's three kinds of consulting in a way. There's kind of analytical consulting where you do reports and study things and look at the numbers and all that's pretty straightforward. You do it well, you don't do it well. There's kind of process consulting where you help a company through and how they're functioning and so on. And if that's sympathetic and done with a lot of finesse, because it takes a lot more finesse than the analytical stuff, then that can be very good. And then there's kind of guru consulting where you sit by the side of a senior manager and just kind of ask embarrassing questions and provoke. And that can be very effective if you're not giving the answers, but rather provoking people to get to their own answers. So consulting varies so widely. There's a lot of awful consulting, there's a lot of wonderful consulting, and I'm very reluctant to. And by the way, the most famous companies, I know lots of examples of awful consulting from famous companies. There's a very well-known consulting firm that was consulting for a major airline years ago, and you had pretty junior consultants sitting there interviewing executives who had been in that company for years and saying, that one gets fired, that one becomes a vice president. This is absolutely irresponsible consulting. No, this is a very famous consulting firm. No company should ever do that. So you get all kinds of behaviors.
Good evening. I just have a question about management styles outside of North America. And as I guess there's been a lot of self-reflection as to what's been done right and what's been done wrong in the last number of years, particularly looking at Asia, some of the large players in Japan or Taiwan or other Asian tigers, is there a management style that's different or unique that is more effective now when you compare it to what's gone on in the U.S. in the last couple of years?
I'm a bit reluctant to say management style. There may be a kind of an organization style. The Japanese, traditionally, the Japanese have been much more concerned with what I would call communityship. They didn't go around firing people casually and so on. People belonged to organizations, and they knew it, although that's lessened a bit, but still pretty strong. The U.S. would be the other extreme, and Britain also, very casual firing. You know, it's one thing to fire people when your back's against the wall like General Motors today. It's quite another thing to fire people because you didn't meet the stock analyst's expectations. You know, why did 5,000 people suddenly become redundant because you didn't make your numbers? You're still profitable, but you're sending a signal to everybody saying, we don't care about you, we have to throw these bones, namely the bones of their so-called human resources, because people are not human beings anymore, they're human resources now. So you throw the bones of your human resources to the stock analysts, and that's not very happy. I can't say the Anglo-Saxon countries, because I think it's been less common here, but in the U.S. and U.K. there's been an awful lot of that, and I think they've depreciated their economy something awful. Do people, let's talk about productivity for a minute. America has been praised for the last decade or more as to how productive it was. It's so wonderfully productive as a society. Now what is productivity? It's a measure of output per labor hour. Okay? If you want to make your company, if you're in a manufacturing company and you want to make it really productive, fire everybody and ship from stock. Very productive until you run out of stock. Okay? I think too many publicly traded companies are running out of stock. They've been, in all kinds of ways. They've been trashing brands, they've been doing all kinds of things to depreciate the company just to boost up the stock price in the short run or to please financial analysts who don't know much about what's going on in the companies. And that's been horribly destructive, and that shareholder value view of the world has been much more common in the U.S. And the U.K. Now, that being said, one of the things I found really interesting is I looked at all the managers in my study, the 29 managers, and I kind of went through all the different factors, like level in the hierarchy, does that matter? Where they come from, does that matter? And so on and so forth. I couldn't find a lot of evidence for culture, where you come from, being a big factor. Bramwell Tovey is the conductor of when I observed him, he was the conductor of the Winnipeg Symphony, now it's Vancouver. He's a Brit conducting in Canada. Do you think he's any different because he's a Brit conducting in Canada? If I watched an Indian conducting in Australia, do you think his style would have been a function of being an Indian or being in Australia? It's an orchestra conductor. He's doing, they vary. Everybody varies. But Fabienne Lavoie was running a pre and post-op surgical ward in a hospital. Do you think she was being hugely different from a head nurse in a hospital in Germany? So I think culture has been hugely overrated, even though I've written about how Canadian managers are so different from American managers and so on. We all like to think that our own country is so different. But maybe we exaggerate those things.
Yes, hi. I think you just touched a bit of what I wanted to ask you actually in that answer, but I was wondering if that book, I mean Managing, if the way it is treated in that book is as more of a North American flavor, or if it applies quite internationally, and if the 29 managers you studied are all based in North America, or are they spread out a bit?
Well, the thing I'm proudest of is there's not a single American in the whole sample. And what I say is that most books have nothing but Americans, so it's time Americans read about other people, number one. Number two, all this research was done in the 1990s. Do you think a head nurse or an orchestra conductor is doing things different in 2009 than in the 1990s? There were various reviewers of the book. One was a retired chief executive of an American company, and he said as soon as they find out there's no Americans and that this was done in the 1990s, they'll put the book down right away. And I quoted that in a footnote, and I said, good, I don't want those people reading my book. If anybody thinks that managing depends on when it was done and that there are Americans or not Americans, then they might as well give up now because you won't understand a damn thing in this book. So the short answer to your question is that I forget the exact number. There's about 8 Canadians, maybe 8 or 10 Canadians. There were a number of Brits, maybe 6 or 8 Brits. There was 2 Australians working at Greenpeace in Amsterdam. There were 3 or more managers in France, the head of Médecins Sans Frontières, the head of a fashion museum, and Jacques Benz, who was president of GSI. And there were the 2 people in the refugee camps in Africa, both of whom were African, a Malian and a Kenyan, in Tanzania. So fairly spread out, not that spread out, but fairly spread out. I had to study people who were French or English speaking, otherwise I wouldn't have known what was going on. So.
I'm happy because I'm going in France at the end of the year, so that's going to be good insight for me.
Thank you again for coming. My question relates to the future direction of McGill's MBA program. Do you think you could come up with a set of principles that we should be heading towards? Do you know of an MBA school that you think is really the best that we should be using as our benchmark? You've said several times that somewhat in a jovial manner you've referenced Harvard and so on. In light of a recent tuition increase at the McGill program, are you worried that we're going to become somewhat over-engineered, for example? What school should we be using as our benchmark?
Nobody. I would maintain, I'm not being facetious, I'm being perfectly serious, we should be copied, not copy. I think we're light years ahead of almost anyone else I can think of. And by the way, the Harvard Business School is now reassessing its MBA program, and the dean has made it clear that the case study method is not on the table for discussion. Okay, that's like General Motors reassessing itself and saying that four-cycle internal combustion engines are not on the table for discussion, or hybrid cars are not on the table for discussion, or nothing but SUVs are on the table for discussion. That would be closer. Don't look to the United States. There's much less innovation in the U.S. There's more innovation in England than anywhere else. We've picked up a lot from them. They picked up a lot from us. I think if you put all our programs together, there's no school in the world that's close to us, frankly, and that includes the new innovations that Susan's been championing in the I saw Susan a minute ago somewhere, but that Susan's been championing in the in our MBA program. So I think, and by the way, Benjamin, you know, let me tell you a story. I had a friend who was a designer, and she was working for Clark Shoes. And she said, Clark Shoes is great. This was years ago, maybe it's changed. But she said, Clark Shoes is great on men's shoes. But on women's shoes, they go to Italy, they get the latest fashions, they come home, and they knock them off. Now, this is 20 years ago, so don't not buy Clark's women's shoes because I'm sure it's all changed. But she said, and they knocked them off. And she said they were very adept at imitating them, but it just, they never got it. It was just never the same. And when you're copy, you're always second best. I'm not a fan of benchmarking. The problem with MBA programs now is that everybody is copying the mainline American schools, and they're the least innovative of all. In England, the most famous schools are Oxford and LBS, London Business School, and so on. Those are not the innovators. They are not the innovators. We're the innovators. We've got all kinds of stuff going on here, and we don't have to apologize to anybody else. We're way ahead.
Professor Mintzberg, over here. You mentioned during the interview that you wouldn't put your money in the stock market. You would more likely put your money in on an entrepreneur because of his maybe passion, determination, long-term vision in his company. But also a lot of literature shows that sometimes they fall in love with their product or their company and they don't make the most objective decisions. So it seems to be, again, a careful balance between objectivity and passion. Now, for a young entrepreneur, do you have any other thoughts on maybe this careful balance that would you like to elaborate on?
You mean in terms of succession, in terms of not losing it, or
in terms of being successful in your venture? It seems to be a compromise.
If you're an entrepreneur, how do you kind of sustain it and don't lose it? You know, every manager walks a very narrow line between confidence and arrogance. You have to have confidence because you're really taking big bets and you're doing critical things. And if you don't have the confidence to say, we'll see this through. Somebody once asked me if entrepreneurs, you know, take risks. And I said, entrepreneurs do not take risks. They do not take risks at all. If you're an entrepreneur, you don't see the downside. You don't accept it. You don't notice it. I'm not saying they're not taking risks. I'm saying they don't accept that there are risks. They are so devoted to success that this is not going to fail no matter what. That's the only way you can succeed as an entrepreneur. Not by, oh my God, woe is me, and look at all these problems. No, we'll overcome. That's the motto of successful entrepreneurs. But you've got to be careful about the other side of that, which is arrogance, which is you take yourself too seriously. I think that's probably not the problem that when entrepreneurs run into problems, it's probably not that problem. It's probably that they're so focused on their particular industry that they don't see things coming from the side sometimes. Years ago, we studied a well-known Montreal supermarket chain called Steinberg's, which was hugely successful in Montreal. But they couldn't do it in Ontario because Sam Steinberg, who was the heart and soul of the company, didn't know Toronto. He didn't buy real estate. The key was that they're buying real estate, not just for real estate, for where ahead of time where they'd put their stores. He didn't do that in Toronto, Ontario. He didn't send a member of the family that he trusted and he lost it. On that side, because what made him so successful in Montreal was what made him unsuccessful in Ontario. Same thing when they went into discount stores. He didn't understand that business in his heart and soul the way he understood the supermarket business. So the danger is you're too narrow. But if you look at IKEA, for example, IKEA's strategy has been pretty stable for a long time. Nobody's been able to touch them so far. IKEA, I think, is a big mess sometimes when it comes to logistics. They're always out of stock. They're just amazing. And I once spoke to somebody in the company. He said, of course, the founder hates planning. So he didn't give a lot of attention to that kind of thing. But they get away with it because if you can't find it in IKEA, where are you going to go? You know, if you like a particular design, you'll wait till they get it in stock. I don't know if it's that bad now, but my experience has always been stock problems in that company. But so, you know, he's not suffering from that problem because they're so locked in to such an... They started in a niche. I mean, this was a niche strategy that became the biggest segment of the whole damn market. Pretty amazing.
Good evening. I believe you mentioned earlier... I believe you mentioned earlier that you don't necessarily believe in young leadership.
Say it again, you don't?
You don't necessarily believe in young leadership.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Young leadership. Yet you have so many examples of successful CEOs, relatively young CEOs and managing directors, partners, etc., in different industries. Can you just elaborate on what you mean by young leadership?
Yeah, I'm a great believer in proven young leadership. I'm just not a great believer in designating someone as a leader because some outsider or more senior person thinks they're so impressive. I think there's only one way. Leadership is earned, to repeat what I said earlier, and the only way you earn it is by proving that you're capable and also proving that people really believe in you and want to follow you and want to do things with you because they find you compelling. So you can be 25 and have all that. I just don't like people in university or whatever being pre-selected, or in high school being pre-selected. Often, you know, I've known many cases, although obviously not all by a long shot, but I've known many cases where somebody was extremely active in high school, was president of the Students' Council, doing all those things, and had a kind of mediocre career. And sometimes the outliers will have much stronger careers. Not always. It goes both ways. But all I'm saying is, you know, being president of the Students' Council, because you got elected and won an election and you're running the Students' Council for a year, doesn't mean you're a great leader. You know, Nelson Mandela, we know, is a great leader. Now, when was that proven? I don't know his history in his early years, so I don't know. But Gandhi's early years, from what I haven't read his history either, but I mean, Gandhi came into his own much later. Would they have identified him as a young leader when he was a lawyer in South Africa? I don't know. Probably not.
This kind of builds on that in a sense. I was going to say, I agree with your point that status is as a leader is not appointed but earned. And I was, you know, so aside from passion in your industry and being somebody who you can look at the history of it, what would you recommend or suggest an individual to do or to adopt habits, to adopt ways of conducting themselves, to allow themselves to cultivate and earn that leadership status?
I think you framed it wrong. I wouldn't frame it that way. I would say you do your best at what you're doing, you devote yourself, you prove that you care about what it is. The bottom line is not that I want to be a leader. The bottom line is not that I want this company to make tons of money. The bottom line in the latter is I want to serve customers so they won't go anywhere else. The bottom line in leadership is I want to do things so well and I want to engage other people so enthusiastically that we're going to do fabulously well. And by the way, I'll be recognized as a good leader. I'm uncomfortable with people who decide they want to be leaders. I think it's too often a sign that they won't be leaders. Not always, but I'm very uncomfortable with people walking around saying, you know, I'm going to be a leader. No, thank you. We follow the strangest people. Who would ever have picked Gandhi to be this sort of amazing leader? Maybe they would have picked Mandela. He has that kind of air. But who would have picked Gandhi to have been so compelling in India? But that also is another answer to your question. There's no such a thing as leadership in general. There's leadership in context. Gandhi was the right man for a very particular circumstance. He wasn't the guy to run Tata Steel in India, but he was the guy to lead India in its independence from England. So leadership is contextual. You're not a leader in everything you do. You're a leader in the circumstances.
I think that was kind of where I was going with it, or was trying to maybe get to, and it was more like if you're passionate about your industry and you want to be a manager in that industry and you want to be effective and you want to see your company achieve results, you know, to what extent or what things can you do aside from purely having the passion, aside from purely being passionate about that industry, to ensure that, like you said, you know, as you said, serving your customers the best, defending your team, representing your team the best.
Perform, but perform largely by getting the people who work with you to perform. In other words, generate the enthusiasm that team is so strong that people can't help but notice. That's the way you do it. Vince Lombardi, kind of an interesting example. Green Bay Packers, sort of legendary coach of the Green Bay Packers. Wasn't a very good football player, from what I understand.
Well, thank you very much, everybody. For the sake of time, unfortunately, we're going to have to stop the session here, but Professor Mintzberg will be signing books afterwards outside, so perhaps you might be able to get a question in or two at that point. But please join me in thanking not only Professor Mintzberg, but all of our panelists as well.